nerves are too close to the surface, and the slightest touch will make them fire. The fringe is where my mother retreated after witnessing a murder. It was where the Bureau found her and rescued her because they suspected her genetic code was sound. Now I will walk there, to the place where, in some ways, it all began. The truck stops, and Amar shoves the doors open. He holds his gun in one hand and beckons to me with the other. I jump out behind him. There are buildings here, but they are not nearly as prominent as the makeshift homes made of scrap metal and plastic tarps piled up right next to one another like they are holding one another upright. And the narrow aisles between them are people, mostly children, selling things from trays or carrying buckets of water or cooking over open fires. When the ones nearest to us see us, a young boy takes off running and screams, "Raid! Raid!" "Don't worry about that," Amar says to me. "They think we're soldiers. Sometimes they raid to transport the kids to orphanages." I barely acknowledge the comment. Instead, I start walking down one of the aisles, as most people take off or shut themselves inside their lean-tos with cardboard or more tarp. I see them through the cracks between the walls. Their house is not much more than a pile of food and supplies on one side and sleeping mats on the other. I wonder what they do in the winter, or what they do for a toilet. I think of the flowers inside the compound, and the wood floors, and all the beds in the hotel that are unoccupied, and say, "Do you ever help them?" "We believe that the best way to help our world is to fix its genetic deficiencies," Amar says, like he's reciting it from memory. "Feeding people is just putting a tiny bandage on a gaping wound. It might stop the bleeding for a while, but ultimately, the wound will still be there." I can't respond. All I do is shake my head a little and keep walking. I'm beginning to understand why my mother joined abnegation when she was supposed to join erudite. If she had really craved safety from erudite's growing corruption, she could have gone to Amity or Candor. But she chose the faction where she could help the helpless, and dedicated most of her life to making sure the factionless were provided for. I must have reminded her of this place, of the fringe. I turn my head away from Amar, so he won't see the tears in my eyes. "Let's go back to the truck." "You all right?"
"Yeah."
We both turn around to head back to the truck, but then we hear gunshots, and right after them, a shout. "Help!" Everyone around us scatters. "That's George," Amar says, and he takes off running down one of the aisles on our right. I chase him into the scrap metal structures, but he's too quick for me, and this place is a maze. I lose him in seconds, and then I am alone. As much automatic, abnegation bred sympathy as I have for the people living in this place, I am also afraid of them. If they are like the factionless, then they are surely desperate like the factionless, and I am wary of desperate people. A hand closes around my arm and drags me backward into one of the aluminum lean-tos. Inside, everything is tinted blue from the tarp that covers the walls, insulating the structure against the cold. The floor is covered with plywood, and standing in front of me is a small, thin woman with a grubby face.
"You don't want to be out there," she says. "They'll lash out at anyone, no matter how young she is."
"They?" I say.
"Lots of angry people here in the fringe," the woman says. "Some people's anger makes them want to kill everyone they perceive as an enemy. Some people's makes them more constructive."
"Well, thank you for the help," I say. "My name is Triss."
"Amy, sit."
"I can't," I say. "My friends are out there."
"Then you should wait until the hordes of people run to wherever your friends are, and then sneak up on them from behind."
"That sounds smart." I sink to the floor, my gun digging into my leg. The bulletproof vest is so stiff it's hard to get comfortable, but I do the best I can to seem relaxed. I hear people running outside and shouting. Amy flicks the corner of the tarp back to see outside.
"So, you and your friends aren't soldiers," Amy says, still looking outside. which means you must be genetic welfare types, right?
No, I say. I mean, they are, but I'm from the city. I mean, Chicago. Amy's eyebrows pop up high.
Damn. Has it been disbanded?
Not yet.
That's unfortunate.
Unfortunate? I frown at her. That's my home you're talking about, you know.
Well, your home is perpetuating the belief that genetically damaged people need to be fixed, that they're damaged, period, which they, we, are not. So yes, it's unfortunate that the experiments still exist. I won't apologize for saying so.
I hadn't thought about it that way. To me, Chicago has to keep existing because the people I have lost lived there, because the way of life I once loved continues there, though in a broken form. But I didn't realize that Chicago's very existence could be harmful to people outside who just want to be thought of as whole.
It's time for you to go, Amy says, dropping the corner of the tarp. They're probably in one of the meeting areas, northwest of here.
Thank you, again, I say. She nods to me, and I duck out of her makeshift home, the boards creaking beneath my feet. I move through the aisles, fast, glad that all the people scattered when we arrived, so there is no one to block my way. I jump over a puddle of, well, I don't want to know what it is, and emerge into a kind of courtyard, where a tall, gangly boy has a gun pointed at George. A small crowd of people surrounds the boy with the gun. They have distributed among them the surveillance equipment George was carrying, and they're destroying it, hitting it with shoes or rocks or hammers. George's eyes shift to me, but I touch a finger to my lips hastily. I am behind the crowd now. The one with the gun doesn't know I'm there.
Put the gun down, George says.
No, the boy answers. His pale eyes keep shifting from George to the people around him and back.
Went to a lot of trouble to get this. Not going to give it to you now.
Then just let me go. You can keep it.
Not until you tell us where you've been taking our people, the boy says.
We haven't taken any of your people, George says. We're not soldiers. We're just scientists.
Yeah, right, the boy says. A bulletproof vest? If that's not soldier shit, then I'm the richest kid in the state. Now tell me what I need to know.
I move back so I'm standing behind one of the lean-tos, then put my gun around the edge of the structure and say,
Hey!
Everyone in the crowd turns at once, but the boy with the gun doesn't stop aiming at George, like I'd hoped.
I've got you in my sights, I say. Leave now, and I'll let you go.
I'll shoot him, the boy says.
I'll shoot you, I say.
We're with the government, but we aren't soldiers. We don't know where your people are. If you let him go, we'll all leave quietly. If you kill him, I guarantee there will be soldiers here soon to arrest you, and they won't be as forgiving as we are.
At that moment, Amar emerges into the courtyard behind George, and someone in the crowd screeches,
There are more of them!
And everyone scatters.
The boy with the gun dives into the nearest aisle, leaving George, Amar, and me alone. Still, I keep my gun up by my face, in case they decide to come back. Amar wraps his arms around George, and George thumps his back with a fist. Amar looks at me, his face over George's shoulder.
Still don't think genetic damage is to blame for any of these troubles?
I walk past one of the lean-tos, and see a little girl, crouching just inside the door, her arms wrapped around her knees. She sees me through the crack in the layered tarps and whimpers a little. I wonder who taught these people to be so terrified of soldiers. I wonder what made a young boy desperate enough to aim a gun at one of them.
No, I say. I don't. I have better people to blame.
By the time we get back to the truck, Jack and Violet are setting up a surveillance camera that wasn't stolen by people in the fringe. Violet has a screen in her hands with a long list of numbers on it, and she reads them to Jack, who programs them into his screen.
Where have you guys been? He says.
We were attacked, George says. We have to leave now.
Luckily, that's the last set of coordinates.
Violet says. Let's get going. We pile into the truck again. Amar draws the doors shut behind us, and I set my gun on the floor with the safety on, glad to be rid of it. I didn't think I would be aiming a dangerous weapon at someone today when I woke up. I didn't think I would witness those kinds of living conditions either. It's the abnegation in you, Amar says. That makes you hate that place. I can tell. It's a lot of things in me. It's just something I noticed in 4, too. Abnegation produces deeply serious people. People who automatically see things like need, he says. I noticed that when people switch to Dauntless, it creates some of the same types. Erudite who switch to Dauntless tend to turn cruel and brutal. Candor who switch to Dauntless tend to become boisterous, fight-picking adrenaline junkies. And Abnegation who switch to Dauntless become, I don't know, soldiers, I guess. Revolutionaries. That's what he could be, if he trusted himself more, he adds. If 4 wasn't so plagued with self-doubt, he would be one hell of a leader, I think. I've always thought that. I think you're right, I say. It's when he's a follower that he gets himself into trouble, like with Nita or Evelyn. What about you? I ask myself. You wanted to make him a follower, too. No, I didn't, I tell myself, but I'm not sure if I believe it. Amar nods. Images from the fringe keep rising up inside me like hiccups. I imagine the child my mother was, crouched in one of those lean-tos, scrambling for weapons because they meant an ounce of safety, choking on smoke to keep warm in the winter. I don't know why she was so willing to abandon that place after she was rescued. She became absorbed into the compound, and then worked on its behalf for the rest of her life. Did she forget about where she came from? She couldn't have. She spent her entire life trying to help the factionless. Maybe it wasn't a fulfillment of her duty as an abnegation. Maybe it came from a desire to help people, like the ones she had left. Suddenly, I can't stand to think of her, or that place, or the things I saw there. I grab onto the first thought that comes to my mind, to distract myself. So, you and Tobias were good friends? Is anyone good friends with him? Amar shakes his head. I gave him his nickname, though. I watched him face his fears, and I saw how troubled he was, and I figured he could use a new life. So I started calling him 4. But no, I wouldn't say we were good friends. Not as good as I wanted to be. Amar leans his head back against the wall and closes his eyes. A small smile curls his lips. Oh, I say. Did you like him? Now, why would you ask that? I shrug. Just the way you talk about him. I don't like him anymore, if that's what you're really asking. But yes, at one time I did, and it was clear that he did not return the particular sentiment, so I backed off, Amar says. I'd prefer if you didn't say anything. To Tobias? Of course I won't. No, I mean, don't say anything to anyone. And I'm not talking about just the thing with Tobias. He looks at the back of George's head, now visible above the considerably diminished pile of equipment. I raise an eyebrow at him. I'm not surprised he and George were drawn to each other. They're both divergent, who had to fake their own deaths to survive. Both outsiders in an unfamiliar world. You have to understand, Amar says. The Bureau is obsessed with procreation, with passing on genes, and George and I are both GPs, so any entanglement that can't produce a stronger genetic code, it's not encouraged. That's all. Ah, I nod. You don't have to worry about me. I'm not obsessed with producing strong genes. I smile wryly. Thank you, he says. For a few seconds we sit quietly, watching the ruins turn to a blur as the truck picks up speed. I think you're good for 4, you know, he says. I stare at my hands, curled in my lap. I don't feel like explaining to him that we're on the verge of breaking up. I don't know him, and even if I did, I wouldn't want to talk about it. All I can manage to say is, oh? Yeah, I can see what you bring out in him. You don't know this because you've never experienced it, but Four Without You is a much different person. He's obsessive, explosive, insecure, obsessive? What else do you call someone who repeatedly goes through his own fear landscape? I don't know. Determined. I pause. Brave. Yeah, sure. But also a little bit crazy, right? I mean, most dauntless would rather leap into the chasm than keep going through their fear landscapes. There's bravery, and then there's masochism. And the line got a little hazy with him. I'm familiar with the line, I say. I know. Amar grins. Anyway, all I'm saying is, anytime you mash two different people against each other, you'll get problems. But I can see that what you guys have is worthwhile. That's all. I wrinkle my nose. Mash people against each other? Really? Amar presses his palms together and twists them back and forth to illustrate. I laugh, but I can't ignore the achy feeling in my chest.
Chapter 35. Tobias. I walk to the cluster of chairs closest to the windows in the control room and bring up the footage from different cameras throughout the city one by one, searching for my parents. I find Evelyn first. She is in the lobby of Erudite headquarters, talking in a close huddle with Therese and a factionless man, her second and third in command now that I am gone. I turn up the volume on the microphone, but I still can't hear anything but muttering. Through the windows along the back of the control room, I see the same empty night sky as the one above the city, interrupted only by small blue and red lights marking the runways for airplanes. It's strange to think we have that in common when everything else is so different here. By now, the people in the control room know that I was the one who disabled the security system the night before the attack, though I wasn't the one who slipped one of their night shift workers' peace serum so that I could do it. That was Nita. But for the most part, they ignore me, as long as I stay away from their desks. On another screen, I scroll through the footage again, looking for Marcus or Johanna, anything that can show me what's happening with the Allegiant. Every part of the city shows up on the screen. The bridge near the Merciless Mart, and the pyre, and the main thoroughfare of the Abnegation Sector. The hub and the Ferris wheel and the Amity Fields now worked by all the factions. But none of the cameras shows me anything.
You've been coming here a lot,
Kara says as she approaches.
Are you afraid of the rest of the compound or of something else?
She's right. I have been coming to the control room a lot. It's just something to pass the time as I wait for my sentence from Triss. As I wait for our plan to strike the Bureau to come together. As I wait for something. Anything. No, I say. I'm just keeping an eye on my parents.
The parents you hate?
She stands next to me, her arms folded.
Yes. I can see why you would want to spend every waking hour staring at people you want nothing to do with. It makes perfect sense.
They're dangerous, I say. More dangerous because no one else knows how dangerous they are but me.
And what are you going to do from here if they do something terrible? Send a smoke signal?
I glare at her.
Fine, fine. She puts up her hands in surrender. I'm just trying to remind you that you aren't in their world anymore. You're in this one. That's all.
Point taken. I never thought of Erudite as being particularly perceptive about relationships or emotions, but Kara's discerning eyes see all kinds of things. My fear, my search for a distraction in my past. It's almost alarming. I scroll past one of the camera angles and then pause and scroll back. The scene is dark because of the hour, but I see people alighting like a flock of birds around a building I don't recognize. Their movements synchronized.
They're doing it, Kara says excited. The Allegiant are actually attacking.
Hey, I shout to one of the women at the control room desks. The older one who always gives me a nasty look when I show up lifts her head. Camera 24, hurry. She taps her screen and everyone milling around the surveillance area gathers around her. People passing by in the hallway stop to see what's happening and I turn to Kara. Can you go get the others, I say. I think they should see this. She nods, her eyes wild, and rushes away from the control room. The people around the unfamiliar building wear no uniform to distinguish them, but they don't wear factionless armbands either, and they carry guns. I try to pick out a face, anything I recognize, but the footage is too blurry. I watch them arrange themselves, motioning to one another to communicate, dark arms waving in the darker night. I wedge my thumbnail between my teeth, impatient for something, anything to happen. A few minutes later, Kara arrives with the others at her back. When they reach the crowd of people around the primary screens, Peter says, "Excuse me," loud enough to make people turn around. When they see who he is, they part for him. "What's up?" Peter says to me when he's closer. "What's going on?" "The Allegiant have formed an army," I say, pointing at the screen on the left. "There are people from every faction in it, even Amity and Erudite. I've been watching a lot lately."
"Erudite?" Caleb says. "The Allegiant are the enemies of the new enemies, the factionless," Kara replies, "which gives the Erudite and the Allegiant a common goal, to usurp Evelyn."
"Did you say they were Amity in an army?"
Christina asks me. "They're not really participating in the violence," I say, "but they are participating in the effort."
"The Allegiant raided their first weapons storehouse a few days ago," the young woman sitting at the control room desk nearest to us says over her shoulder. "This is their second. That's where they got those weapons. After the first raid, Evelyn had most of the weapons relocated, but this storehouse didn't make it in time."
My father knows what Evelyn knew, that the power to make people fear you is the only power you need. Weapons will do that for him.
"What is their goal?" Caleb says. "The Allegiant are motivated by the desire to return to our original purpose in the city," Kara says. "Whether that means sending a group of people outside of it as instructed by Edith Pryor, which we thought was important at the time, though I've since learned that her instructions didn't really matter, or reinstating the factions by force. They're building up to an attack on the factionless stronghold. That's what Johanna and I discussed before I left. We did not discuss allying with your father, Tobias, but I suppose she's capable of making her own decisions."
I almost forgot that Kara was the leader of the Allegiant before we left. Now I'm not sure she cares whether the factions survive or not, but she still cares about the people. I can tell by the way she watches the screens, eager but afraid. Even over the chatter of the people around us, I hear the gunfire when it starts. Just snaps and claps in the microphones. I tap the glass in front of me a few times, and the camera angle switches to one inside the building the invaders have just forced their way into. On a table within is a pile of small boxes, ammunition and a few pistols. It's nothing compared to the guns the people here have in all their abundance, but in the city, I know it's valuable. Several men and women with factionless armbands guard the table, but they are falling fast, outnumbered by the Allegiant. I recognize a familiar face among them, Zeke, slamming the butt of his gun into a factionless man's jaw. The factionless are overcome within 2 minutes, falling to bullets I see only when they're already buried in flesh. The Allegiant spread through the room, stepping over bodies like they are just more debris, and gathering everything they can. Zeke piles stray guns on the table, a hard look on his face that I've only seen a few times. He doesn't even know what happened to Uriah. The woman at the desk taps the screen in a few places. On one of the smaller screens above her is an image, a piece of the surveillance footage we just watched, frozen at a particular moment in time. She taps again, and the image moves closer to its targets. A man with close-cropped hair and a woman with long, dark hair covering one side of her face. Marcus, of course, and Johanna, carrying a gun. Between them, they have managed to rally most of the loyal faction members to their cause. Surprisingly, though, the Allegiant still don't outnumber the factionless. The woman leans back in her chair and shakes her head. "There were far more factionless than we ever anticipated. It's difficult to get an accurate population count on a scattered population, after all." "Johanna? Leading a rebellion with a weapon? That makes no sense," Caleb says. "Johanna told me once that if the decision had been up to her, she would have supported action against Erudite instead of the passivity the rest of her faction advocated. But she was at the mercy of her faction and their fear. Now, with the factions disbanded, it seems she has become something other than the mouthpiece of Amity, or even the leader of the Allegiant. She has become a soldier." "Makes more sense than you'd think," I say, and Kara nods along with my words. I watch them empty the room of weapons and ammunition and move on, fast, scattering like seeds on the wind. I feel heavier, like I am bearing a new burden. I wonder if the people around me, Kara, Christina, Peter, even Caleb, feel the same way. The city, our city, is even closer to total destruction than it was before. We can pretend that we don't belong there anymore while we're living in relative safety in this place. But we do. We always will.
Chapter 36. Triss. It's dark and snowing when we drive up to the entrance of the compound. The flakes blow across the road, as light as powdered sugar. It's just an early autumn snow. It will be gone in the morning. I take off my bulletproof vest as soon as I get out and offer it to Amar along with my gun. I'm uncomfortable holding it now, and I used to think that my discomfort would go away with time. But now I'm not so sure. Maybe it never will, and maybe that's all right. Warm air surrounds me as I pass through the doors. The compound looks cleaner than ever before, now that I've seen the fringe. The comparison is unsettling. How can I walk these squeaky floors and wear these starchy clothes when I know that those people are out there, wrapping their houses in tarp to stay warm? But by the time I reach the hotel dormitory, the unsettled feeling is gone. I scan the room for Christina or for Tobias, but neither of them is there. Only Peter and Caleb are. Peter with a large book on his lap, scribbling notes on a nearby notepad, and Caleb reading our mother's journal on the screen, his eyes glassy. I try to ignore that. Have either of you seen... But who do I want to talk to? Christina or Tobias? Four? Caleb says, deciding for me. I saw him in the genealogy room earlier. The what room? They have our ancestors' names on display in a room. Can I get a piece of paper? He asks Peter. Peter tears a sheet from the back of his notepad and hands it to Caleb, who scribbles something on it, directions. Caleb says, I found our parents' names there earlier, on the right side of the room, second panel from the door. He hands me the directions without looking at me. I look at his neat, even letters. Before I punched him, Caleb would have insisted on walking me himself, desperate for time to explain himself to me. But recently, he has kept his distance, either because he's afraid of me, or because he has finally given up. Neither option makes me feel good. Thank you, I say. How's your nose? It's fine, he says. I think the bruise really brings out my eyes. Don't you? He smiles a little, and so do I. But it's clear that neither of us knows what to do from here, because we both run out of words. Wait, you were gone today, right? He says after a second. Something's happening in the city. The Allegiant rose up against Evelyn, attacked one of her weapons storehouses. I stare at him. I haven't wondered about what was happening in the city for a few days now. I've been too wrapped up in what's happening here. The Allegiant? I say. The people currently led by Johanna Reyes? Attacked a storehouse? Before we left, I was sure the city was about to explode into another conflict. I guess now it has. But I feel detached from it. Almost everyone I care about is here. Led by Johanna Reyes and Marcus Eaton, Caleb says. But Johanna was there, holding a gun. It was ludicrous. The Bureau people seemed really disturbed by it. Wow. I shake my head. I guess it was just a matter of time. We lapse into silence again, then walk away from each other at the same time, Caleb returning to his cot, and me walking down the hallway, following Caleb's directions. I see the genealogy room from a distance. The bronze walls seem to glow with warm light. Standing in the doorway, I feel like I am inside a sunset, the radiance surrounding me. Tobias's fingers run along the lines of his family tree, I assume, but idly, like he's not really paying attention to it. I feel like I can see that obsessive streak Amar was referring to. I know that Tobias has been watching his parents on the screens, and now he is staring at their names, though there's nothing in this room he didn't already know. I was right to say that he was desperate. Desperate for a connection to Evelyn. Desperate not to be damaged. But I never thought about how those things were connected. I don't know how it would feel, to hate your own history and to crave love from the people who gave that history to you at the same time. How have I never seen the schism inside his heart? How have I never realized, before, that for all the strong, kind parts of him, there are also hurting, broken parts? Caleb told me that our mother said there was evil in everyone, and the first step to loving someone else is to recognize that evil in ourselves, so we can forgive them. So how can I hold Tobias's desperation against him, like I'm better than him, like I've never let my own brokenness blind me? Hey, I say, crushing Caleb's directions into my back pocket. He turns, and his expression is stern, familiar. It looks the way it did the first few weeks I knew him, like a sentry guarding his innermost thoughts. Listen, I say. I thought I was supposed to figure out if I could forgive you or not. But now, I'm thinking you didn't do anything to me that I need to forgive. Except maybe accusing me of being jealous of Nita. He opens his mouth to interject, but I hold up a hand to stop him. If we stay together, I'll have to forgive you, over and over again. And if you're still in this, you'll have to forgive me over and over again, too, I say. So forgiveness isn't the point. What I really should have been trying to figure out is whether we were still good for each other or not. All the way home, I thought about what Amar said, about every relationship having its problems. I thought about my parents, who argued more often than any other abnegation parents I knew, who nonetheless went through each day together until they died. Then I thought of how strong I have become, how secure I feel with the person I now am, and how all along the way he has told me that I am brave, I am respected, I am loved and worth loving. And, he says, his voice and his eyes and his hands a little unsteady. And, I say, I think you're still the only person sharp enough to sharpen someone like me. I am, he says roughly, and I kiss him. His arms slip around me and hold me tight, lifting me onto the tips of my toes. I bury my face in his shoulder and close my eyes, just breathing in the clean smell of him, the smell of wind. I used to think that when people fell in love, they just landed where they landed, and they had no choice in the matter afterward. And maybe that's true of beginnings, but it's not true of this. Now, I fell in love with him. But I don't just stay with him by default, as if there's no one else available to me. I stay with him because I choose to. Every day that I wake up, every day that we fight or lie to each other or disappoint each other, I choose him over and over again. And he chooses me. Chapter 37. Triss. I arrive at David's office for my first council meeting just as my watch shifts to 10, and he pushes himself into the hallway soon afterward. He looks even paler than he did the last time I saw him, and the dark circles under his eyes are pronounced, like bruises. "Hello, Triss," he says. "Eager, are you? You're right on time." I still feel a little weight in my limbs from the truth serum Kara, Caleb, and Matthew tested on me earlier as part of our plan. They're trying to develop a powerful truth serum, one that even GPs, as serum-resistant as I am, are not immune to. I ignore the heavy feeling and say, "Of course I'm eager. It's my first meeting. Want help? You look tired." "Fine, fine." I move behind him and press into the handles of the wheelchair to get it moving. He sighs. "I suppose I am tired. I was up all night dealing with our most recent crisis. Take a left here." "What crisis is that?" Oh, you'll find out soon enough. Let's not rush it. We maneuver through the dim hallways of Terminal 5, as it is labeled. An old name, David says, which have no windows, no hint of the world outside. I can almost feel the paranoia emanating from the walls, like the terminal itself is terrified of unfamiliar eyes. If only they knew what my eyes were searching for. As I walk, I get a glimpse of David's hands, pressed to the armrests. The skin around his fingernails is raw and red, like he chewed it away overnight. The fingernails themselves are jagged. I remember when my own hands looked that way, when the memories of fear simulations crept into every dream and every idle thought. Maybe it's David's memories of the attack that are doing this to him. I don't care, I think. Remember what he did, what he would do again. Here we are, David says. I push him through a set of double doors, propped open with doorstops. Most of the council members seem to be there, stirring tiny sticks and tiny cups of coffee, the majority of them men and women David's age. There are some younger members. Zoe is there, and she gives me a strained but polite smile when I walk in. Let's come to order, David says as he wheels himself to the head of the conference table. I sit in one of the chairs along the edge of the room, next to Zoe. It's clear we're not supposed to be at the table with all the important people, and I'm okay with that. It'll be easier to doze off if things get boring. Though if this new crisis is serious enough to keep David awake at night, I doubt it will. Last night, I received a frantic call from the people in our control room, David says. Evidently, Chicago is about to erupt into violence again. Faction loyalists, calling themselves the Allegiant, have rebelled against factionless control, attacking weapons safe houses. What they don't know is that Evelyn Johnson has discovered a new weapon, stores of death serum kept hidden in erudite headquarters. As we know, no one is capable of resisting death serum, not even the Divergent. If the Allegiant attack the factionless government, and Evelyn Johnson retaliates, the casualties will obviously be catastrophic. I stare at the floor in front of my feet as the room bursts into conversation. Quiet, says David. The experiments are already in danger of being shut down if we cannot prove to our superiors that we are capable of controlling them. Another revolution in Chicago would only cement their belief that this endeavor has outlived its usefulness, something we cannot allow to happen if we want to continue to fight genetic damage. Somewhere behind David's exhausted, haggard expression is something harder, stronger. I believe him. I believe that he will not allow it to happen. It's time to use the memory serum virus for a mass reset, he says. And I think we should use it against all four experiments. Reset them? I say, because I can't help myself. Everyone in the room looks at me at once. They seem to have forgotten that I, a former member of the experiments they're referring to, am in the room. Resetting is our word for widespread memory erasure, David says. It is what we do when the experiments that incorporate behavioral modification are in danger of falling apart. We did it when we first created each experiment that had a behavioral modification component, and the last one in Chicago was done a few generations before yours. He gives me an odd smile. Why did you think there was so much physical devastation in the factionless sector? There was an uprising, and we had to quell it as cleanly as possible. I sit, stunned in my chair, picturing the broken roads and shattered windows, and toppled streetlights in a factionless sector of the city, the destruction that is evident nowhere else, not even north of the bridge, where the buildings are empty but seem to have been vacated peacefully. I always just took the broken-down sectors of Chicago in stride, as evidence of what happens when people are without community. I never dreamed that they were the result of an uprising and a subsequent resetting. I feel sick with anger, that they want to stop a revolution, not to save lives, but to save their precious experiment would be enough. But why do they believe they have the right to rip people's memories, their identities, out of their heads, just because it's convenient for them? But of course, I know the answer to that question. To them, the people in our city are just containers of genetic material. Just GDs. Valuable for the corrected genes they pass on, and not for the brains in their heads or the hearts in their chests. When? One of the council members says. Within the next 48 hours, David says. Everyone nods, as if this is sensible. I remember what he said to me in his office. If we are going to win this fight against genetic damage, we will need to make sacrifices. You understand that, don't you? I should have known then that he would gladly trade thousands of GD memories, lives, for control of the experiments, that he would trade them without even thinking of alternatives, without feeling that he needed to bother to save them. They're damaged, after all.
Chapter 38. Tobias. I prop up my shoe on the edge of Triss's bed and tighten the laces. Through the large windows, I see afternoon light winking in the side panels of the parked airplanes on the landing strip. GDs in green suits walk across the wings and crawl under the noses, checking the planes before takeoff. How's your project with Matthew going? I say to Kara, who is two beds away. Triss let Kara, Caleb, and Matthew test their new truth serum on her this morning, but I haven't seen her since then. Kara is pushing a brush through her hair. She glances around the room to make sure it's empty before she answers.
Not well. So far, Triss was immune to the new version of the serum we created. It had no effect whatsoever. It's very strange that a person's genes would make them so resistant to mind manipulation of any kind.
Maybe it's not her genes, I say, shrugging. I switch feet. Maybe it's some kind of superhuman stubbornness.
Oh, are we at the insult part of the breakup, she says. Because I got in a lot of practice after what happened with Will. I have several choice things to say about her nose.
We didn't break up, I grin, but it's nice to know you have such warm feelings for my girlfriend.
I apologize. I don't know why I jumped to that conclusion.
Kara's cheeks flush.
My feelings toward your girlfriend are mixed, yes, but for the most part I have a lot of respect for her.
I know, I was just kidding. It's nice to see you get flustered every once in a while. Kara glares at me. Besides, I say, what's wrong with her nose?
The door to the dormitory opens and Triss walks in, hair unkempt and eyes wild.
It unsettles me to see her so agitated, like the ground I'm standing on is no longer solid. I get up and smooth my hand over her hair to put it back into place. What happened? I say, my hand coming to rest on her shoulder.
Council meeting,
Triss says. She covers my hand with hers, briefly, then sits on one of the beds, her hands dangling between her knees.
I hate to be repetitive, Kara says, but what happened?
Triss shakes her head like she's trying to shake the dust out of it.
The council has made plans. Big ones.
She tells us in fits and starts about the council's plan to reset the experiments. As she speaks, she wedges her hands under her legs and presses forward into them until her wrists turn red. When she finishes, I move to sit beside her, putting my arm across her shoulder. I look out the window at the planes perched on the runway, gleaming and poised for flight. In less than 2 days, those planes will probably drop the memory serum virus over the experiments. Kara says to Triss,
"What do you intend to do about it?" "I don't know," Triss says. "I feel like I don't know what's right anymore."
They're similar, Kara and Triss. Two women sharpened by loss. The difference is that Kara's pain has made her certain of everything, and Triss has guarded her uncertainty, protected it, despite all she's been through. She still approaches everything with a question instead of an answer. It is something I admire about her, something I should probably admire more. For a few seconds we stew in silence, and I follow the path of my thoughts as they turn over and over one another.
They can't do this, I say. They can't erase everyone. They shouldn't have the power to do that.
I pause. All I can think is that this would be so much easier if we were dealing with a completely different set of people who could actually see reason. Then we might be able to find a balance between protecting the experiments and opening themselves up to other possibilities.
Maybe we should import a new group of scientists,
Kara says, sighing,
and discard the old ones.
Triss's face twists and she touches a hand to her forehead, as if rubbing out some brief and inconvenient pain.
No, she says. We don't even need to do that.
She looks up at me, her bright eyes holding me still.
Memory serum,
she says.
Alan and Matthew came up with a way to make the serums behave like viruses, so they could spread through an entire population without injecting everyone. That's how they're planning to reset the experiments, but we could reset them.
She speaks faster as the idea takes shape in her mind, and her excitement is contagious. It bubbles inside me like the idea is mine and not hers. But to me it doesn't feel like she's suggesting a solution to our problem. It feels like she's suggesting that we cause yet another problem.
Reset the Bureau and reprogram them without the propaganda, without the disdain for GDs. Then they'll never risk the memories of the people in the experiments again. The danger will be gone forever.
Kara raises her eyebrows.
Wouldn't erasing their memories also erase all of their knowledge, thus rendering them useless? I don't know. I think there's a way to target memories depending on where the knowledge is stored in the brain. Otherwise, the first faction members wouldn't have known how to speak or tie their shoes or anything.
Triss comes to her feet.
We should ask Matthew. He knows how it works better than I do.
I get up too, putting myself in her path. The streaks of sun caught on the airplane wings blind me so I can't see her face. Triss, I say. Wait. You really want to erase the memories of a whole population against their will? That's the same thing they're planning to do to our friends and family. I shield my eyes from the sun to see her cold look, the expression I saw in my mind even before I looked at her. She looks older to me than she ever has, stern and tough and worn by time. I feel that way too.
These people have no regard for human life, she says. They're about to wipe the memories of all our friends and neighbors. They're responsible for the deaths of a large majority of our old faction.
She sidesteps me and marches toward the door.
I think they're lucky I'm not going to kill them.
Chapter 39. Triss. Matthew clasps his hands behind his back.
No, no. The serum doesn't erase all of a person's knowledge, he says. Do you think we would design a serum that makes people forget how to speak or walk? He shakes his head. It targets explicit memories, like your name, where you grew up, your first teacher's name, and leaves implicit memories, like how to speak or tie your shoes or ride a bicycle, untouched.
Interesting, Kara says. That actually works. Tobias and I exchange a look. There's nothing like a conversation between an erudite and someone who may as well be an erudite. Kara and Matthew are standing too close together, and the longer they talk, the more hand gestures they make.
Inevitably, some important memories will be lost, Matthew says. But if we have a record of people's scientific discoveries or histories, they can relearn them in the hazy period after their memories are erased. People are very pliable then.
I lean against the wall.
Wait, I say. If the Bureau is going to load all of those planes with the memory serum virus to reset the experiments, would there be any serum left to use against the compound?
We'll have to get it first, Matthew says, in less than 48 hours.
Kara doesn't appear to hear what I said.
After you erase their memories, won't you have to program them with new memories? How does that work?
We just have to reteach them. As I said, people tend to be disoriented for a few days after being reset, which means they'll be easier to control. Matthew sits and spins in his chair once. We can just give them a new history class, one that teaches facts rather than propaganda.
We could use the Fringe's slideshow to supplement a basic history lesson, I say. They have photographs of a war caused by GPs.
Great, Matthew nods. Big problem, though. The memory serum virus is in the weapons lab. The one Nita just tried
and failed to break into. Christina and I were supposed to talk to Reggie, Tobias says, but I think, given this new plan, we should talk to Nita instead. I think you're right, I say. Let's go find out where she went wrong. When I first arrived here, I felt like the compound was huge and unknowable. Now, I don't even have to consult the signs to remember how to get to the hospital, and neither does Tobias, who keeps stride with me on the way. It's strange how time can make a place shrink, make its strangeness ordinary. We don't say anything to each other, though I can feel a conversation brewing between us. Finally, I decide to ask. What's wrong? I say. You hardly said anything during the meeting. He shakes his head. I'm not sure if this is the right thing to do. They want to erase our friends' memories, so we decide to erase theirs? I turn to him and touch his shoulders lightly. Tobias, we have 48 hours to stop them. If you can think of any other idea, anything else that could save our city, I'm open to it. I can't. His dark blue eyes look defeated, sad. But we're acting out of desperation to save something that's important to us, just like the Bureau is. What's the difference? The difference is what's right, I say firmly. The people in the city as a whole are innocent. The people in the Bureau, who supplied Janine with the attack simulation, are not innocent. His mouth puckers, and I can tell he doesn't completely buy it. I sigh. It's not a perfect situation. But when you have to choose between two bad options, you pick the one that saves the people you love and believe in most. You just do, okay? He reaches for my hand, his hand warm and strong. Okay. Tris! Christina pushes through the swinging doors to the hospital and jogs toward us. Peter is on her heels, his dark hair combed smoothly to the side. At first I think she's excited, and I feel a swell of hope. What if Uriah is awake? But the closer she gets, the more obvious it is that she isn't excited. She's frantic. Peter lingers behind her, his arms crossed. I just spoke to one of the doctors, she says, breathless. The doctor says Uriah's not going to wake up. Something about... no brainwaves. A weight settles on my shoulders. I knew, of course, that Uriah might never wake up. But the hope that kept the grief at bay is dwindling, slipping away with each word she speaks. They were going to take him off life support right away, but I pleaded with them. She wipes one of her eyes fiercely with the heel of her hand, catching a tear before it falls. Finally, the doctor said he could give me 4 days, so I can tell his family. His family. Zeke is still in the city, and so is their dauntless mother. It never occurred to me before that they don't know what happened to him, and we never bothered to tell them, because we were all so focused on... They're going to reset the city in 48 hours, I say suddenly, and I grab Tobias's arm. He looks stunned. If we can't stop them, that means Zeke and his mother will forget him. They'll forget him before they have a chance to say goodbye to him. It will be like he never existed. What? Christina demands, her eyes wide. My family is in there. They can't reset everyone. How could they do that? Pretty easily, actually, Peter says. I had forgotten that he was there. What are you even doing here? I demand. I went to see Uriah, he says. Is there a law against it? You don't even care about him, I spit. What right do you have? Tris. Christina shakes her head. Not now, okay? Tobias hesitates, his mouth open, like there are words waiting on his tongue. We have to go in, he says. Matthew said we could inoculate people against the memory serum, right? So we'll go in, inoculate Uriah's family just in case, and take them back to the compound to say goodbye to him. We have to do it tomorrow, though, or we'll be too late. He pauses. And you can inoculate your family too, Christina. I should be the one who tells Zeke and Hannah anyway. Christina nods. I squeeze her arm, in an attempt at reassurance. I'm going to, Peter says. Unless you want me to tell David what you're planning. We all pause to look at him. I don't know what Peter wants with a journey into the city, but it can't be good. At the same time, we can't afford for David to find out what we're doing. Not now, when there's no time.
Fine, Tobias says. But if you cause any trouble, I reserve the right to knock you unconscious and lock you in an abandoned building somewhere.
Peter rolls his eyes.
How do we get there? Christina says. It's not like they just let people borrow cars.
I bet we could get a Mart to take you, I say. He told me today that he always volunteers for patrols, so he knows all the right people, and I'm sure he would agree to help Uriah and his family.
I should go ask him now, and someone should probably sit with Uriah. Make sure that doctor doesn't go back on his word. Christina, not Peter.
Tobias rubs the back of his neck, pawing at the Dauntless tattoo, like he wants to tear it from his body. And then, I should figure out how to tell Uriah's family that he got killed when I was supposed to be looking out for him.
Tobias, I say, but he holds up a hand to stop me. He starts to move away.
They probably won't let me visit Nita anyway.
Sometimes, it's hard to know how to take care of people. As I watch Peter and Tobias walk away, keeping their distance from each other, I think it's possible that Tobias needs someone to run after him, because people have been letting him walk away, letting him withdraw, his entire life. But he's right. He needs to do this for Zeke, and I need to talk to Nita.
Come on, Christina says. Visiting hours are almost over. I'm going back to sit with Uriah.
Before I go to Nita's room, identifiable by the security guard sitting by the door, I stop by Uriah's room with Christina. She sits in the chair next to him, which is creased with the contours of her legs. It's been a long time since I've spoken to her like a friend. A long time since we laughed together. I was lost in the fog of the bureau, in the promise of belonging. I stand next to her and look at him. He doesn't really look injured anymore. There are some bruises, some cuts, but nothing serious enough to kill him. I tilt my head to see the snake tattoo wrapped around his ear. I know it's him, but he doesn't look much like Uriah without a wide smile on his face, and his dark eyes bright, alert.
He and I weren't really even that close, she says. Just at the very end, because he had lost someone who died, and so had I.
I know, I say. You really helped him.
I drag a chair over to sit next to her. She clutches Uriah's hand, which stays limp on the sheets.
Sometimes, I just feel like I've lost all my friends, she says.
You haven't lost Kara, I say, or Tobias.
And Christina, you haven't lost me. You'll never lose me.
She turns to me, and somewhere in the haze of grief, we wrap our arms around each other, in the same desperate way we did when she told me she had forgiven me for killing Will. Our friendship has held up under an incredible weight. The weight of me shooting someone she loved, the weight of so many losses. Other bonds would have broken. For some reason, this one hasn't. We stay clutched together for a long time, until the desperation fades.
Thanks, she says. You won't lose me either.
I'm pretty sure if I was going to, I would have already. I smile.
Listen, I have some things to catch you up on.
I tell her about our plan to stop the Bureau from resetting the experiments. As I speak, I think of the people she stands to lose. Her father and mother, her sister, all those connections, forever altered or discarded in the name of genetic purity.
I'm sorry, I say when I finish. I know you probably want to help us, but don't be sorry.
She stares at Uriah. I'm still glad I'm going into the city. She nods a few times. You'll stop them from resetting the experiment.
I know you will. I hope she's right.
I only have 10 minutes until visiting hours are over when I arrive at Nita's room. The guard looks up from his book and raises his eyebrow at me.
Can I go in? I say.
Not really supposed to let people in there, he says.
I'm the one who shot her, I say.
Does that count for anything?
Well, he shrugs, as long as you promise not to shoot her again, and get out within 10 minutes.
It's a deal. He has me take off my jacket, to show that I'm not carrying any weapons, and then he lets me into the room. Nita jerks to attention.